In previous studies of more than 13,000 Europeans, almost 6% said that they had an out-of-body experience, like near death. Dr. Kevin Nelson and a research team at the University of Kentucky have studied the link between out-of-body experiences, the sleep-wake transition, and near-death experiences. They published their findings in the issue of the journal Neurology in their case report, Out-of-Body Experience and Arousal. The results are intriguing and show that some people's brains already may be predisposed to these sorts of experiences. They found that an out-of-body experience is statistically as likely to occur during a near-death experience as it is to occur during the transition between wakefulness and sleep. Nelson suggests that the phenomena is the brain's arousal system, which regulates different states of consciousness, including REM sleep and wakefulness, and may be the cause for these types of out-of-body displays. Interesting, isn't it? In a moment, Dr. Jeffrey Long joins us. We'll talk about this study and a number of other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jeffrey Long is a leading near-death experience researcher. Dr. Long founded the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. All his websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And he developed two other websites devoted to experiences related to NDE, After Death Communication Research Foundation, and Out-of-Body Experience Research Foundation. Family of websites is the largest publicly accessible collection of exceptional human experiences of their type available. Portions of the website have been posted in more than 20 foreign languages. Over 1,000 experiences have been posted, making all of them, of course, the largest number of NDEs ever studied, and by far the largest number of NDEs that are publicly accessible in the world. Dr. Long, physician, actively practicing the medical specialty of radiation oncology. That's the use of radiation to treat cancer. He is from New Mexico. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Jeffrey, welcome back. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be back, George.
This study by Dr. Nelson and his group at the University of Kentucky, now, is he backing the fact that near-death experiences are real, or is he simply saying they're a process of the brain?
Well, the study that he's published in the very prestigious medical journal Neurology has led him to state that, at least in his terms, that it's highly suggestive, or certainly that the possibility that near-death experiences are all in the brain is consistent with his research findings. And that's what this study purports to state. Certainly I have a very different opinion, and we'll certainly talk about, I hope we have time to talk about Dr. Nelson's study as well as some of my own research, and we'll let your listeners come up with their own conclusions about where the truth lies.
Well, you're on for 3 hours, Jeffrey, so we'll have enough time to talk about every study known to man, I think.
Okay.
I tend to agree with you. You know, I have fielded so many phone calls over the last 5 years on this program from people who have had near-death experiences, people who have had out-of-body experiences, and it is beyond, I think, the power of the brain.
Well, I think there's no question about that. So I'm sure you and your listeners are scratching their head a little bit and saying, well, given all that we've heard, you know, how could a study come along that would even suggest something that seems so contrary to what's been shared so extensively over all these years? And I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on Dr. Nelson's study, but I think we should probably take a look at that a little bit more critically and try to decide if the study really justifies the type of conclusions that it made.
Why do you think, though, he came up with these conclusions? Because he seems to pass over the supernatural aspect of this.
Well, you know, absolutely. I think if you're going to determine what the cause of near-death experiences is, that is, why they happen, you really need to look at all possibilities. And you certainly need to consider that there may be things other than the brain activity involved in this, that there may be something that is medically inexplicable. And that's hard for mainstream medical researchers to really grasp or understand. And yet, certainly I think as we'll talk about this as we go on tonight, I think the overwhelming preponderance of the evidence suggests that the near-death experience and the out-of-body experience associated with it is absolutely something separate from the brain. But we'll get into that in a lot more detail, I'm sure.
Tell me a little bit about your work, Jeffrey.
Sure. As you said earlier, I have the largest collection of near-death experiences that's ever been assembled, and I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the over 1,000 people that have had these exceptional experiences that have shared it with our website over the years. That's allowed us to learn more about near-death experience and a lot of its aspects than has ever been possible before just because of the huge volume of experiences that we have to research as part of our website and part of our Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. So that's been a major part of what I do. Interestingly, I have nothing for sale. We don't solicit donations. My whole goal in doing this type of research, George, is just to simply find the truth and share it with the world. It's that simple. And we'll talk about some of my findings tonight.
Gallup poll 1982 estimated that 12 to 15 million Americans experienced some kind of near-death experience. That's huge.
And that's absolutely correct. That's about 4% of the American adult population from the Gallup survey at that point in time, a very credible, obviously, type of survey that was done back then. And further, that same percentage was collaborated by a German study of adults just a few years ago that found about 5% of the adults have near-death experience. So they're unusual, but certainly not rare. And certainly there are millions and millions of people that have had these types of experiences.
Now, when I get phone calls, Jeffrey, it's from some people, they experience certain things, and we'll take calls at the end of the program tonight from people. And you can ask for specific calls if you like as well. But is an NDE a person who has biologically died where the heart stops or there's no function? Or is it just someone who sees the light at the end of the tunnel or something like that?
You know, and that's a good question because there's a lot of different concepts, even among major researchers, about just what a near-death experience is. The elements of the experience, i.e. the out-of-body experience initially, seeing yourself going through a tunnel, seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, deceased relatives, life review, these are widely known to the American public. So a lot of people think that if you have experiences, any type of experience that incorporates these types of elements, then that makes it a near-death experience. And I don't really buy into that. I think the very term near-death experience indicates that you have to be physically near-death. There has to be some substantial compromise. And in the 1,000 near-death experiences I've accrued, we really like to have them physically compromised, heart stop, breathing stop, or at least so physically impaired that they're literally unconscious, that they shouldn't be having a conscious event. And yet, for near-death experiencers, they do.
However, OBEs, totally different.
They're totally different. They can occur in a variety of different circumstances. In fact, as you mentioned earlier, 6% of the population may have experienced out-of-body experiences not associated with a life-threatening event. And in fact, other studies suggest the percentage is even higher, maybe in the 15 to 20% range. But out-of-body experiences that occur not associated with the near-death experience are very, very different. The elements of the experience are completely different from the elements that occur during near-death experience on the average, which is one of the things that Dr. Nelson's study failed to consider.
I was going to say, why does this study seem to lock in the fact that OBEs and near-death, that they may be similar? Why didn't they separate those?
Well, I think the issue with this study here is that they just simply asked fairly simplistic questions. That is, have you ever had your consciousness apart from the body or had an out-of-body experience? And I think their conclusions would have been very, very different if they'd gone the extra step that we do as part of our Near-Death Experience Research Foundation work, where we ask for people to give a very, very detailed account of exactly what happened. We have, of course, the Near-Death Experience website that has over 1,000 near-death experiences, and we actually have over 1,000 out-of-body experiences that have been shared with my other website. So it's been very, very easy for me to compare these two types of experiences and come to conclusions about just exactly what their similarities are. And the bottom line is, by and large, they're profoundly different. Out-of-body experiences, if you're not near-death or close to dying or your heart stopped, you've stopped breathing, are very, very different types of experiences than occur with near-death experiences.
Do we even know why this study occurred? I mean, who would even think about this at this point?
Well, I think, well, first of all, Dr. Nelson is a brilliant neurologist. I certainly support anybody who has any hypothesis about the cause of near-death experience. I strongly encourage this type of research. in order for us, George, to conclude that near-death experience is medically inexplicable, in order scientifically for that to be established, you have to look at all possible alternative hypotheses that possibly could exist, even if they don't, you know, you and I and your listeners know, you know, isn't necessarily, you know, in our opinion, going down the right path. So, you know, certainly it's worth a try. It's worth taking a stab at it, but only after you have a number of people test these different hypotheses, explore them, have them discussed scientifically in the literature, I think, and then found not to hold water. You know, I think then and only then can you be absolutely certain that these experiences, these incredible experiences, are medically inexplicable, and that has profound implications.
Because one would assume, after looking at this study, that when one physically dies, when the brain stops to function, when it ceases, all these other things then would not exist.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, if you, a lot of the people that share near-death experiences are physically unconscious, and often at times they're in a deep coma. You know, the possibility of there being any brain function at this point in time that could produce the highly detailed, lucid, ordered experience that occurs with a near-death experience is just absolutely, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't sound like that's possible at all. And further, certainly the Dr. Nelson study didn't consider that a number of near-death experiences occur while the person is under general anesthesia. There's a surgical complication, heart stops, and they have a near-death experience. Well, when you're under general anesthesia, there's absolutely no way you're going to be able to form a lucid, organized thought. You know, you have two things impairing your ability, your consciousness. You have general anesthesia, which completely shuts down the brain, and then secondly, your heart stops, and that's very well documented during near-death experiences in anesthesia. And again, for that reason alone, you would have no potential to have an organized, conscious thought. And yet these people have tremendously vivid and detailed experiences that they share later.
In your opinion, then, there is an afterlife, right?
I think the evidence is overwhelming for that based on the research that I've done. And certainly the people that have these types of experiences are almost unanimous that that's what's going on, too. I think that certainly there's really no logical alternative hypothesis for the fact that, that these experiences are real. And the consistency of the elements of these experiences strongly suggests that not only, George, is there an afterlife, but we're starting to learn a little bit about what that afterlife might be. And I hope we have a chance to talk more about that this evening.
How similar, then, is an OBE from an NDE in that, to me, an OBE is primarily tied into someone who's alive, has an ability to leave one's body, can meditate. Maybe it's accidental. That's how it happened to me when I was 11 years old, totally accidental, never able to do it again. But there are some similarities here as well. They seem to go through the same layers, dimensions, or whatever they may be.
Yeah, and that's a good point. There's no question in the over 1,000 out-of-body experiences that people have shared with the OBE website I have over the years. There's no question there's some of them that are just, in fact, a large number that are absolutely evidential by even the strictest criteria. They absolutely do happen. However, with Dr. Nelson's article, when he talked about out-of-body experiences and its possibility of being due to the arousal system, what he was specifically studying in this article was the out-of-body experiences that occur associated with either immediately after falling asleep or right before waking up. So these are waking state is a technical term for it, hallucinations, as he calls them, that occur at that point in time. Especially if an OBE is occurring during that time, a point in time, as opposed to OBEs like you described, meditation experiences or experiences, OBEs with NDEs in particular, the OBEs that occur right at the moment of falling asleep or waking up are absolutely, the elements are absolutely different from the near-death experience. They bear no similarity whatsoever. In fact, it's almost wrong to use the term out-of-body experiences to refer to that class of experiences and the OBE occurring during NDE, because they really aren't the same.
Now, they've talked about sleep paralysis. That happens. That's real.
Absolutely.
What's the tie-in? That's strictly medical?
Yeah, that's getting into some of the details of Dr. Nelson's article. When you studied these types of hallucinations that occur right at the time you're falling asleep or right at the time you're waking up, those two types of hallucinations can be called visual. You see things that aren't really there at this time, or auditory. You may hear things that occur that are not actually real at that point in time. And sleep paralysis is also part of what can occur at this time when you're falling asleep or waking up. All those types of visual and auditory hallucinations or sleep paralysis are technically medically called REM intrusion. And I might explain that a little bit because that's probably not a familiar term to many of your listeners. REM is, of course, R-E-M, and that stands for rapid eye movement. Now, George, rapid eye movement sleep is actually a normal phase of sleep. It's usually, and we all have it, it's usually associated with vivid, emotionally intense, bizarre, story-like dreams. During REM, or rapid eye movement, the eyes move rapidly under closed eyelids, breathing may become irregular, blood pressure may rise, and that's typically the time at this point where you have muscle tone paralysis, hence sleep paralysis.
Right.
And the Dr. Nelson article is talking about the phenomenon of what's called REM intrusion. Now, normally REM occurs several times during the course of a night's sleep, usually, as I said, shortly before you fall asleep or shortly before you wake up. But occasionally this REM, this rapid eye movement type phenomena, occurs when the individual is awake around that point in time. And you start seeing these things that aren't real, hearing things that aren't real, or feel paralyzed when they're awake. And that's called REM intrusion. George, you're probably saying, geez, that didn't sound much like a near-death experience.
Not at all.
And I totally agree.
Can you have similar near-death experiences where people have similarities to different people, or are they all different?
You know, in the over 1,000 I've reviewed, I've never seen two that are absolutely the same.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. They all have similar elements, but they're all. It's just amazing how there's some slight variations when you have the out-of-body experience associated with near-death experience. The point of consciousness may be directly above or to the side. Point of consciousness may actually be at ground level on much lesser occasions. But especially for the more detailed experiences, while there's no question that there's similarity of the elements, they're never really identical. And actually, I find that very reassuring. If there was any chance that these were copycat experiences or one person copying another, you might occasionally see identical experiences. But again, you go to the website and you look at the over 1,000 experiences posted there, and believe me, hundreds of thousands of people have over the years, and there's just simply no two experiences that are identical.
You're an oncologist. What got you interested in this field?
Well, that's a good question. Many, many years ago, when I was doing my residency training in radiation oncology, purely by accident, I happened across an article on near-death experience in one of the most prestigious medical journals around, the Journal of the American Medical Association. I read it and was immediately stunned. I said, how can thousands of people have such similar experiences when they're clinically dead? And I said, that's absolutely impossible. I've been through medical school, and I know fully well that there's no way that you can have a conscious experience when your heart stops. In fact, when you clinically die, within 10 seconds, electroencephalogram, which is a measure of brain electrical activity, goes flat. You can't even theoretically have a conscious experience, and yet this is the time when people have these near-death experiences. When they see their resuscitation efforts, they're way over 10 seconds into their cardiac arrest. So I was immediately astonished. I really thought this would be an interesting thing to pursue further. And then a couple years later, I had a friend visiting me in Iowa City where I was doing my training. And his wife came along and just mentioned that she had died on the operating table due to an allergy. I asked some pointed questions, and I got a whopper of a story, George. My first person sharing a near-death experience verbal with me, her consciousness rose up above the operating room table. She described frantic efforts to try to resuscitate her. And again, here we go again. She was under general anesthesia. She had no chance of having this REM intrusion. Her brain was shut down, both from anesthesia and her cardiac arrest. But then, interestingly, in her experience, her consciousness drifted into the area of the nursing station, and she could see and hear what the nurses were doing at the time she is clinically coded on the table. Absolutely medically inexplicable.
That blows their mind when they come back and tell the nurses and doctors what they heard, doesn't it?
And that happened.
We'll be back in a moment. Don't go away. Jeffrey, you have three different websites, all important websites. Why not just one big one?
Well, the experiences that are shared on those three websites are very different from each other. Of course, we have one devoted to near-death experience, and that's the main website. But after-death communication, certainly you can encounter deceased relatives during near-death experiences, so there's some relation with near-death experiences, but there's a whole slew of after-death communication experiences that occur unrelated to a life-threatening event. And then certainly the out-of-body experience website that I have has the whole flotsam and jetsam of out-of-body experiences that are not associated with nearly dying. And so I thought it was important to split those up a little bit just so that we could understand each of them individually, sort of honor each type of experience in its own way.
When people tend to have these experiences, why do they seem to be able to remember them when they come back, either back into their physical bodies or when they awake?
Why
do they remember the experience? How can they remember the experience?
Oh, you mean like with a near-death experience?
Yeah, that's
a good point. They shouldn't be able to have any conscious memory. They shouldn't be able to form an experience. And on top of that, exactly is the point you're making, they shouldn't be able to remember anything either.
Most people can't even remember their dreams.
Yes, and especially with, and that's absolutely true. I mean, if you think about a dream you had two nights ago, you're probably going to draw a blank. But with near-death experiences, what's astonishing is not only that people do remember it, but there's actually been prospective studies where people shared a near-death experience within several weeks after it occurred, and then they asked them to repeat the experience a year later and then up to 8 years later after that. To the researchers' astonishment, the near-death experiences were shared almost word for word verbatim, exactly as it was within several weeks of its occurrence. So these people, not only do they remember it, but they remember it for years and years and years with, you know, essentially no distortion or alteration. And I think that's a very important validating thing about near-death experience. That's nothing like dreams or other altered states of consciousness, nothing like hallucinations.
Why do people in this state seem to be able to hear things and see things in detail?
And that's a really good point, because what they do when they're clinically dead, of course they shouldn't be able to see or hear anything.
No, you wouldn't think so.
But very, very typically, they have an out-of-body experience. Their point of consciousness rises above the body, and they can see and hear things going on around them. Now, the critical issue here is what they see and hear real? If it were a dream, a hallucination, if it were a false memory, then, of course, you would expect that what they see or hear is distorted, totally unrealistic, has nothing to do with the real environment going on around them, and yet, study after study after study, including my own data, with this huge data set of over 1,000 near-death experiences, is extremely clear. What these people see and what they hear when they're in that out-of-body state during a near-death experience is absolutely real.
The evidence behind this, we don't have hard evidence. We have testimony. That's about it, or is there more?
Well, again, you have to go back to a fundamental tenet of science, and that is scientifically what is real, what scientifically will stamp or validate as being real, is something that is consistent through repeated observations. And so for near-death experiences, we have mammoth numbers, literally thousands between my own and other researchers' investigations and publications, and all of it's coming up certainly with the same conclusion. Clearly, on many, many observations, fulfilling that scientific criteria for reality. There's no question about that. And, you know, you talk to the near-death experiencers, I mean, not only is it just fragmentary things that they see and hear, I mean, what they see and hear can be very vivid and very, very detailed. You know, speaking medically as a doctor, you know, what you may see on television or believe occurs during a resuscitation when someone's heart stops is one thing, but gosh, when you talk to these near-death experiencers, they'll often describe panic, things are, the crash cart's not where it's supposed to be, you know, there may be some unprofessional behavior and conduct, unfortunately, mm-hmm. often doctors. But, you know, it's nothing like what you would expect, and yet this is exactly what near-death experiencers describe over and over and over. I mean, there's no way they could have known what goes on in a real resuscitation unless they saw it.
Some of them have religious experiences. Why?
Well, we don't really understand, you know, why some of them seem to have religious experiences. Some do, some don't, and it's one thing that we do know is that the near-death experience, really, as far as the elements it has, the major elements, is not really particularly associated with their prior religious beliefs. Atheists have near-death experiences, and of course, it's extremely difficult for them to continue to be atheists after they have a very vivid spiritual experience like this. But there doesn't seem to be any particular correlation with prior religious beliefs. And in fact, there doesn't even seem to be a correlation with religious beliefs, even if they're non-Western beliefs. We have a fairly large collection of Muslim, Hindu experiences from all around the world. And, you know, if these were due to prior belief or prior religious training, you'd think that the near-death experiences coming from these non-Western civilizations would be distinctly different from American or Western civilization near-death experiences. But to our astonishment, George, we're not seeing that. It's clear that these non-Western NDEs are far more similar, even with different religious backgrounds, are far more similar than dissimilar from Western NDEs.
Are you pretty well satisfied that there could be enough evidence out there where you could say then beyond a shadow of a doubt, because I know you said you believe there's an afterlife, but in terms of hard evidence, if this thing were brought into a court of law, could you prove that the other side exists?
I'll have to answer that directly. That's a direct question, so it deserves a direct answer. I would have to say yes. And by the way, for a court of law, my wife is an attorney.
Okay.
And by the way, she's a webmaster, and she goes over the same evidence I do. And even with her legal background, she has come to the same conclusion that I have. And we've talked about this at great length. We believe the evidence is so overwhelming for a variety of reasons. The reproducibility of elements, its medical inexplicability, the fact that blind people, even blind from birth, can have visual near-death experiences. Recently, we found the first deaf person, deaf from birth, who had a near-death experience and was communicating with his deceased relatives in a way that did not involve reading, hand signs, but more the typical telepathic communication, which is absolutely inexplicable. So the totality of the evidence, in my opinion, is overwhelming and certainly satisfies me beyond the shadow of a doubt. And further, I'm certainly in good company because that's almost the unanimous impression of people that actually have near-death experiences. From their point of view, they believe that they clearly crossed over, literally crossed over into another realm and came back.
Even though they're different, are you picking up similarities as well then?
Yeah, absolutely. The well-known similarities, such as the out-of-body experience, going through tunnel, encountering deceased relatives. George, if near-death experiences were related to brain function, you wouldn't expect to encounter almost exclusively people that had died previously. You'd expect to see people that were in the forefront of your memory,
mm-hmm.
your friends, neighbors, family, people that are alive, people you interacted with, people that are your recent memory. But we've actually, part of the study we have, and we've actually looked at that issue directly as part of our ongoing research, and we found out of the first 130 NDEs that we looked in detail at that, there was only one where they encountered a living person. Every other single time where they encountered beings that were known to them, but known from their earthly existence, every single time other than that, these were people that were deceased, predominantly deceased relatives, but it could be deceased friends as well.
Have you ever had people testify that they have seen pure evil on the other side?
Yes, I sure have. Now, that's rare. About 5% of the experiences do contain very, very frightening, sometimes very graphically frightening imagery. Some of the most horrific things that I have read in my life were not books or not fiction, but it was nonfiction and came from these types of truly hellish near-death experiences. Again, we don't know why they happen, but there's no question they're real. Now, while they only occur about 5% of the time, by the time you roll up 1,000 near-death experiences, we have a very large series of these things. So no doubt that they're real. They're part of the spectrum of near-death experiences, and they certainly can be very, very frightening.
Some people testify that they hear incredible sounds in music. Why?
And it just seems to be part of leaving the earthly realm. Generally, when people hear this type of music, and it's often the words near-death experiencers use to describe this music is just incredible. It's like, you know, every orchestra on earth multiplied by a million in terms of its beauty and majesty. I mean, these are the kind of expressions that are just incredible that they use. Generally, people hear this the kind of music, and it's, you know, maybe in the 5 to 10% range of near-death experiencers have this. Generally, they're in the unearthly realm. Very often this is associated with seeing other aspects of a heavenly realm, and it certainly makes an enormous impression. In fact, a few people have tried to reproduce the music that they heard during their near-death experience on Earth, and some of it's just incredible, but they're quick to explain that the music they heard was truly unearthly in its beauty, and while they can try and even perhaps come somewhat close, you know, they'll miss by a mile. I mean, it's just really literally outside of this world.
Is that where we sometimes would hear stories of trumpets playing and things like that?
You know, you almost never hear people describe in terms of earthly terms like an instrument like a trumpet. I mean, it's usually described, the music seems to be extraordinarily complex, extraordinarily detailed, often, you know, seems to be the participants in the that are generating the music are often large numbers of beings. But it's it's clear when they talk about this, words can't even really describe the majesty, the incredible music that they hear during these experiences.
Let's talk a little bit more about this tunnel, Jeffrey.
Sure.
Tunnel of light, tunnel of darkness. Might it be like a wormhole in the universe?
You know, that's an interesting speculation, and the real answer is we just don't know. But certainly what I see over and over is that very typically in a near-death experience, they start out with an out-of-body experience, and then, maybe around a third of the people will have this tunnel experience. And very typically, the tunnel's very variably described. I mean, some people describe it as a fairly simple tunnel, and other people describe it as having colors, texture, different sizes, shapes. They often describe going through the tunnel at an enormous rate of speed. Very typically, classically, there will be a light at the end of the tunnel. And when they pass through the tunnel, you know, consistent with your thought that it might be a wormhole or something like that, generally after they pass through the tunnel, that's when they're encountering beings of light, unearthly beings, deceased relatives, heavenly realms, more typically after the tunnel than before it.
Where does reincarnation fit into this, Jeffrey?
Well, that's interesting. A lot of near-death experiencers, a far higher percentage of people that have had a near-death experience believe in reincarnation than people have not had a near-death experience. And a lot of that, of course, is directly related to the experience that they have. It's not unusual when people have these unearthly experiences where they're in a different non-earthly realm during a near-death experience that they encounter other beings. And sometimes they encounter these other beings in what is represented to them during the experience that they're in the process of being born or preparing to go back to Earth. So that, I think, has led to a lot of people actually directly observing things that make them believe in reincarnation. And then a second thread of observation for near-death experiencers that leads them to believe in reincarnation occurs during the life review. Occasionally, not very often, but occasionally people will review their life, but sometimes, in addition to just reviewing their current earthly life, they go back even further, and sometimes they see prior lives, often in very great detail, often with some very fairly specific ideas about where they were, what their gender were. They weren't necessarily male or female as they were in this earthly existence. And some of these stories are just absolutely dramatic from observations and writings about far prior times, earthly times.
Yeah, give us an example or two of something like that, the kind of stories you've heard.
For like a life review?
Yeah.
Very typically, a life review can be either portions of your prior life, which is probably more typical. Well, first of all, let me back up. A life review during a near-death experience, if they're going to have a tunnel experience, it's almost always after they've had the tunnel experience. Very often they'll meet a being of light, and very often there's another being with them. The other being will show them their prior life, either fragments of it, portions of it, or occasionally what we call panoramic life review. This can occur remarkably, even from the time they're born or from the time of their earliest physical consciousness or memory, and it goes all the way up through the time that they had their life-threatening event that precipitated the near-death experience. What's absolutely astounding is that, again, if these were brain functions or hallucinations, then this past life review wouldn't be real. It would contain some elements that were fictitious. And time again, and we're actually looking at this objectively in the research I do, These life reviews are absolutely plausible. And if you'd like, I could give you an example of
Sure.
just how detailed these are.
Absolutely.
And this is just one example out of literally hundreds I have. But okay, and this is an actual account posted on the NDERF website. This was a lady who had a very panoramic life review as part of her near-death experience, and she wrote this one example out of the myriad of experiences that she was having as part of the life review. She saw herself as a three-year-old. And again, mind you, this was a an adult in her, I don't remember how old she was, but probably in the 30s or 40s years old. But she saw herself as part of her panoramic life review as a three-year-old. And she was in the bathtub, and her father was giving her a bath. And she saw herself jump out of the tub and laughing and having a great time, run out of the bathroom, run down the hallway dripping wet. And she was aware of her thinking at this point in time, at the age of three, that she was having a great time, and she assumed her father would feel that this was a joyous and happy experience for him, too. But during her life review, not only was she reliving and remembering her own feelings, even at the age of three, but at this point she was able to feel literally what her father felt like at this point in time. And to her abject surprise, she realized all of a sudden that her father had had a very difficult day at work. Her father was very tired, and her father was absolutely having no fun whatsoever chasing her all through the house, and that this was an extremely heavy burden to him, and he was not at all happy. And she had no way of knowing that until she had her life review.
Do people talk about angelic experiences?
Yeah, it's interesting because the term angel is rarely used.
Really?
Yeah, and that's what's very surprising about this. I would have expected if there were a lot of religious beliefs that creeped into these things, you'd hear, they describe beings of light, and that's a classic description in the near-death experience, but it's very unusual. Not rare necessarily, but certainly very unusual that people describe these as angels. And when you get into the stereotypic view of an angel where they have wings or halos, that's truly rare in a near-death experience. So what they're describing, they may feel they're angel-like, but it seems to be, for the near-death experiencers, quite a bit different from their stereotypic view of an angel.
Can you train someone to experience a near-death experience, or is it just simply an OBE?
Yeah, I think people can have out-of-body experiences, and there's a whole host of ways that people can, have talked about how they might possibly have out-of-body experiences to induce them, if you will. But as far as the near-death experience, you really have to nearly die to have a near-death experience. And I would emphasize,
we don't want to do that.
Yeah, you absolutely don't want to do that. That's extremely dangerous. And clearly, near-death experiencers, when they come back, they're very, very clear that it is absolutely wrong in a very moral, very universal way to try to induce an end to your own life. They're adamant that that's not appropriate.
In OBEs, people talk about visiting other planets throughout the universe. In NDEs, do they see things that are unusual, or do they all generally see the same thing?
Well, they're generally seeing very different things. You raise an interesting issue about travel to other planets during OBEs. There are some very uncommon to rare NDEs where they actually go and visit other planets. Now, it's not at all unusual during a near-death experience where they're out in space and they see the Earth at a distance. But once in a while, we get these very striking near-death experiences where they actually describe going to visit other planets. And I remember one vivid near-death experience posted on the website where they saw both an advanced civilization and as well as a very primitive civilization.
During an NDE?
During a near-death experience, direct, detailed observations of an advanced as well as, on a different planet, a very primitive civilization.
That's
just amazing.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. Absolutely riveting discussion with Dr. Jeffrey Long. We'll be back in a moment. Much more to talk with him about. In the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you to share your experiences, to ask your questions. Okay, Jeffrey, you were telling us about the NDEs, near-death experiences, and people seeing other planets.
Absolutely. And George, furthermore, you expressed some interest in hearing a little bit more about the example I brought up. I have my computer in front of me, and I actually pulled up an experience that has exactly that type of thing that happened during the near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's on my website. It's labeled Roger C's Near-Death Experience. Want to hear a little more?
Please.
Okay. Roger C., and this is from many, many years ago, so I've pulled it up, and I'm actually going to read it. He was involved in a head-on car collision and immediately had severe head trauma, and he immediately had an out-of-body experience where he could see himself and actually had a lady with him as well, and both of them were unconscious laying in the car. for his experience, he didn't have a tunnel, but remember, actually, over 50% don't. But very quickly, he found himself in a different realm where he had a very detailed life review. And we've talked about that. But this is what makes this experience astounding. And we actually asked him what happened next. And again, this is coming straight from Roger C's NDE posted on the website. And I quote, "In an instant, I was there on another planet. I was able to see my body there." And he says, "I can't see my body in the light," from the prior part of the experience being in the light. Roger C goes on to say, "I'm in the presence of people and am able to talk to them. How great," I thought. "They were amazed to see me in front of them. I was in some sort of city with flat ground. There were buildings with no windows nor doors, just like big boxes. They had a special way to enter them, but it wasn't very important for me to know it. We were communicating with voice, but through the minds, telepathic. And I was able to understand each word in French," and Roger C. is French, so it was in French to him. "And while I was talking," again, "with these advanced beings, I know that they were using another language with them, and this was all done automatically. These advanced beings on the other planet were asking Roger C. where I came from. They wanted to see in my mind the stars I could see from my planet. The result was good. They were also asking me where on Earth I was born, what was the area I like to see, and what I like to do on Earth." And he told him, it goes on in the account to tell him how he was born in a town of Canada. These advanced beings wanted to see in his mind what it looks like and a map of these areas. And they asked him to show him if he wanted to. I mean, they gave him a choice to show or not show, of course. The result, again, was good, as Roger C. was mentally able to show them a map. And then, interestingly, the advanced beings ask him where I was taking the energy to survive. And he knew right away they were talking about food in a strange way. So I told them about the plants we eat on Earth. And then they also said, "Are you eating what used to be alive?" And Roger C. said, "Yes." And the advanced beings told him, "We knew there were primitive civilizations, but not as bad as that."
They were even a dead plant, huh?
Yeah, I mean, they were shocked that they were eating previously living things. And they were surprised that someone coming from such a primitive world could meet them on their own planet. So absolutely astounding. And then he goes on and went to another planet. Well, backing up a little bit. He talks about their physical appearance. They're shorter, they walked slower, they didn't have any hair. He talks about a strange uniform they had that molded around their skin as if they were part of it. They couldn't really tell easily where the uniform began or ended. So, again, you know, this goes quite a bit of detail, and I don't know how much you or your listeners would be interested.
Well, no, keep going.
Okay, I will. George, I'll be frank. I started reading this during the break, and I got chills. This is just incredible.
And you're sure it's a near-death experience, not an out-of-body experience or a remote view?
Right. I checked that. Again, to reiterate, this guy was involved in a severe head-on collision. He lost control of his car, immediately had severe head trauma, immediately had an out-of-body experience, physically unconscious, both him and the lady that was with him in the car. And he was able to observe that, with the initial part of the experience being an out-of-body experience. I mean, they were unconscious. And that is, you know, clearly an imminent life-threatening event to have a wreck with that bed. So this is part of what happened. So while he's physically unconscious, George, this is what's going on, which is incredible. I mean, I hadn't reviewed this for years, so this is a real adventure to me, too. I'm delighted to continue to share from this absolutely remarkable account. The advanced beings go on to tell him, "This is interesting. We might go to see your planet sometime in the near future, but it is very far from here." Roger C. says, "No problems, but be careful." He then said goodbye and thanked him for the information, and he went from them at night and took some time to look at the stars. It was nothing like on Earth, and there wasn't any moon, but the sky was beautiful with a lot of stars. So that's just incredible.
That is a strange story.
I mean, it's just incredible. We mentioned earlier that there was that this individual visited a primitive planet as well. As part of his experience, he did another visit to a less primitive environment. And here's what he said when asked directly, and I quote again from Roger C. from a posted experience: "There were some primitive cavemen full of hair chasing strange animals, big ones. I tried to communicate with them, but with no results, interestingly. they can't see me nor hear me. It wasn't too interesting there, so he then made a decision to return to the light, which he'd been at previously as part of his experience, as part of his life review. So again, George, absolutely incredible where there seems to be some direct knowledge, direct observation of an advanced civilization.
And interesting that they don't understand propulsion, because they said, you know, we could visit you, but it's too far away. They obviously haven't wrestled with, you know, the bending of space and time.
Well, actually, the actual words they used is they said, and let me read this again. Yeah, again, reading verbatim, they told me we might go to see your planet sometime in the near future, but it is very far from here. So, George, I read that and interpret that as indicating that they do have the ability to visit the planet, and the fact that they say they could visit it in the near future, and again, it's hard to say what their concept of near future
is. Yeah, I was going to say it could be a million years.
Yeah, it could be, but you know, it certainly sounds like, even though it's a very far away planet and certainly very far from Earth, that they certainly are capable of visiting it.
What got him to where he went? I mean, how did he get there? Did somebody summon him over there? Was he forced to go there? How did he get there?
You almost never during a near-death experience are forced into anything. That's extraordinarily rare. Yeah, and all he says here that after he had his life review, he says, quote, in an instant I was there on another planet, exclamation mark. So this was just part of his, he didn't go through a tunnel. He just sort of went out-of-body experience to, boom, he was in this unearthly realm where he was having a very detailed life review from my review of this account, and then, boom, he's on this particular type of planet and has this very detailed interaction with these beings and then went to another one. So I don't think he was being forced. This was just part of what was a his experience.
Does anybody report seeing deceased animals, pets?
Yes, that's not at all unusual. Fairly commonly, they see their deceased pets, dogs, cats, birds. All of those have been described in a variety of near-death experiences.
Well, we got a Clydesdale today on one of our earlier hours.
Oh, that's the first horse I've heard, but you know, certainly consistent with, you know, a long-term pattern of deceased animals of importance, George. Just like with the deceased relatives you encounter, when you encounter people that you knew previously on Earth during a near-death experience that died. Even if they had chronic illnesses, were debilitated mentally and physically, severely impaired by their disease process that ultimately killed them, when they're encountered in the near-death experience, they're essentially always the picture of health. Sometimes they're years to even decades younger, and the encounter is always a loving one. It's not like a ghost or frightening or anything. I mean, these are joyous encounters, and the same thing happens with animals, particularly beloved pets. No matter how the pet died or how ill they were, or how injured. The pet is full of health, and again, it's a very loving, very dramatic, really neat descriptions we see over and over in these near-death experiences.
Do you believe that the loved one who seems to be next to the person who's had the near-death experience, that they are assigned to be there, forced to be there? I mean, why are they around?
Right, good question. Once again, It is essentially unknown in any of these near-death experiences with over 1,000 I've reviewed where anybody's forced to do anything. So I would say, and again, given the joyousness, the reunion that happens when they encounter their deceased relatives, at no level do I get any hint that they're forced. In fact, it sounds like it's an incredibly happy, positive thing for the deceased individual to encounter. And it's not just visual. They'll touch, they'll hug, they'll interact. There's communication. It's just very, very touching when I read these types of experiences. So I think it's just part of. And again, we don't know. Of course, the real answer is we don't know why some NDEs have an encounter with deceased friends or loved ones, predominantly relatives. Now, we don't know why that happens or why it doesn't. But you know, certainly it does happen. It's fairly common. My best guess, and again, this is just a hypothesis. You know, that these experiences are co-created, and there's probably some meaning or purpose that is especially important for that near-death experiencer that they have that particular element. And again, that's hard for us to understand why, but you know, no question, it's a very important part of the near-death experience for these people that have it when that type of thing happens.
Dr. L, how does this explain ghosts and spirits, or does it?
This really doesn't, because when they encounter deceased relatives, I cannot recall at this point anything that sounds like a ghost, where they were a deceased relative was frightening, where they seemed to be, well, other than frightening NDEs, which is rare. But for the great, great majority of these, they're in unearthly realms. It's a very positive, very, very touching part of it. I mean, immediately they recognize the deceased relative. It's not like a ghost where you kind of wonder what you see or you're not sure. It seems to be very, very clear, you know, what all's going on. The communication's very, very clear. So I don't see that aspect of near-death experience is helping address the mystery of ghosts.
See, I always thought that a ghost or a spirit was one that just did not go into the light and cross over. So if somebody's having an NDE and a loved one comes by, you know, either to convince them to go back or maybe to help them, why haven't they crossed over, the loved one?
Oh, the loved ones, when they encounter them, they've clearly crossed over.
They have the ability to come back?
Yeah, and I think they do, but again, they almost always encounter the deceased relatives in unearthly realms. I don't think it's so much a matter that the deceased relative has come back to Earth, if you will. I think it's that the person having the near-death experience has transcended into another realm, and that's where they're able to meet these people. One interesting NDE that's directly relevant to ghosts, just this last weekend, we got a near-death experience account where an individual had clinically certainly met all physical compromise criteria for near-death experience, but interestingly, immediately in their experience, they encountered their cousin. And their cousin and this person having the near-death experience traveled together through a tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, this person having a near-death experience described her cousin going through a life review. But guess what, George? This person had no knowledge at the time of the near-death experience that the cousin had died that night, the night of the near-death experience, in an actually very far geographically removed in a different state. And only after this person woke up from this recovered from this amazing experience, then they checked around, and then they were informed that the cousin who had been with them in this experience had died that night.
If you had the ability to get to the other side as Dr. Jeffrey Long, not as somebody who had an NDE, what would you be looking for? What kind of answers would you want?
I'd love to do that. I mean, a researcher's dream,
yep,
to actually go and have direct observation. One thing that I would do, I think, is go over there, and first and foremost, I've developed an enormous amount of respect for the intense love, for the intense wisdom that's on the other side. I mean, that's very consistently described with the near-death experiencers. I think if I were to have an experience like that, first and foremost, I would go into that with a level of humility. I would ask them, what knowledge should I take back? What's important? What would be the most loving thing that I could bring back to the world and share and help further the mission that we all feel is so important? What could I do to bring back some of this incredible light that we have in the unearthly realm and share that light with the world? That would be what I'd want to do.
Do you think you'd ever come across the devil somewhere?
You know, and it's hard to say. It's the devil or certainly people describe demonic beings. They're rare. They do exist. Sometimes they're associated with near-death experiences where they may encounter these types of beings early in the experience, and then as the experience continues, it may transform into a more positive, pleasant experience, and that's not unusual. Do I think I'd encounter the devil? I don't think so. I'm certainly not worried about it, frankly.
What do you recommend people do with your websites? Can they participate in anything?
Oh, absolutely. If anybody has had a near-death experience, an after-death communication, out-of-body experience, there's forms on the website. Now more than ever, we're doing research and learning from these experiences at a level we never have before. So now more than ever, if you've got the time to fill out those web forms, we would greatly appreciate that. The knowledge that we learn from each individual experience and from the experiences collectively, you know, as we've shared tonight, is certainly changing our views about these types of experiences and helping us all collectively understand them.
In a near-death experience, a person basically has died for the moment, and then they come back. In an actual death, all conjecture on your part, but in an actual death, is it the same thing?
I think the best evidence suggests that it is, and I'll tell you what the strongest evidence for that is, George. Occasionally there's auto accidents, there's other types of accidents, combat's not unusual, where two separate people suffer imminent life-threatening events at the same time. We have a few accounts where one of the individuals had a near-death experience and the other individual died. During the experience, the near-death experiencer brings back, there's actually the two of them together. They're both in the out-of-body state. They're able to interact. They're able to see their body. They're aware that they're, you know, quite messed up from the accident, and that's often vividly shared between the two of them. And yet, in these unusual, but, you know, we do have a series of these types of experiences, the one person who dies then goes on. And so all evidence is from these so-called shared near-death experiences, where one returns to tell the tale and the other one does not, all evidence from that does suggest these near-death experiences are the type of thing that people experience when they go through when they actually permanently die and don't come back to Earth.
Some people always say that they come up to a gate, the pearly gates, they come up to a barrier, something that is there that separates where they're going. Why is that?
You know, that's interesting, and that's the element of near-death experiences called a barrier, and it's not at all unusual. Pearly gates are actually pretty rare, although we do have some accounts that describe that. Most often the barrier is described this way. Very typically, a barrier that's encountered will be involved as part of the experience where they're, say, walking down a path. And on both sides of the path, there will be a fence. Very often on the other side of the fence, there may be beautiful areas. There may be people that they can't necessarily interact with. But as they go down the path, there may be a small creek that goes across the path,
sure,
or even more typically, a bridge as part of the path. Now, when I read these near-death experiences, and frankly, I've seen this so many times, I know exactly what's going to happen. The near-death experiencer, and very often there's someone with the NDE or in this part of the experience walking with them, communicating with them, sharing whatever they've shared during the experience, often very loving interaction. As they come down to that little creek that crosses the path or the bridge that comes up, they stop, and they become aware that they can't go over that, because to go over that would mean that they couldn't return to Earth. Very often at that point in experience, at that point of the barrier, that's when the decision is made to return to Earth, and that's often dramatically described. Believe it or not, the great majority of near-death experiencers that actually are involved in a choice during their NDE about whether to return to Earth, the great majority don't want to return, which is incredible.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a lot of calls that I got, and I'm sure you'll get some next hour, people don't want to come back.
No, and it's incredible because understand they have loved ones, they have friends,
yeah,
family, they have children. But let me explain that from the near-death experiencer's point of view.
Let's do that when we come back.
Okay.
Jeffrey, tell us why people just don't want to come back. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And then let's finish up the hour by talking a little bit more about Dr. Kevin Nelson's research. And I really want to get your take on that. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Dr. Jeffrey Long. Jeff, let's talk now why some people just don't want to come back.
Okay. Yeah, it's really interesting, and, you know, it's so odd for your listeners to say, gosh, you know, you're in a life-threatening event. All that you know, all you remember has been your earthly existence. Maybe a good example of this would be to read directly from what a near-death experiencer shared. That'd be good. Here's just a typical example of the kind of decision people have to make as far as returning, and I quote, "Next thing I remember is suddenly finding myself back in the presence of the being of light I'd met first and told I had to go back. I said, no way, I won't. I was told that it wasn't my time, that I'd been granted a visit, quote, back home, unquote, that being the heavenly realm,
mm-hmm,
but that I had to fulfill my purpose and do the work I myself had chosen to do on Earth. The being of light reminded me that my purpose was to learn more about love, compassion, and how to express them on Earth, and that my work was to help other people in any way I could. I had chosen this myself, and it told me that I would be back in the world of light, that's the heavenly realm, in no time. Never forget, in reality there is no time, only eternity itself, it said." So, this is just unquote, that's just a very, you know, gripping, dramatic example, and yet very typical about what people go through when they make these decisions. Well, over and over I hear for people that make a decision that want to stay, the reason they want to stay is that they know full well in these heavenly realms when they're around beings of light, when they're feeling intense feelings of connection, of love, Indiaeans understand that that is their real home, that Earth is not their real home.
Right, and it must be just so peaceful.
The peace, the love, the connection, the knowledge, the wisdom, the compassion. That's what's so striking, is that why would you want to go away from this home of great beauty, of literally of heaven, and come back to an earthly realm? And they realize that Earth is nowhere near like the environment they're in. They don't have that love in Earth. They don't have that knowledge, that connection. Over and over, Indiaeans protest that Earth is very crude, very unloving, and it's not where they want to be.
Of the 1,000-plus NDEs that you've studied, of those special ones, how many of those could you categorize as having some kind of a spiritual or religious overtone?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a lot of it depends on how you define spiritual or religious, and actually the near-death experiencers themselves pretty typically make a distinction between being spiritual and religious. They usually, you know, consider spiritual to be literally of spirit, or being that of the unseen, unknown, mystical realm, and distinguish that from religious, which is a product, if you will, of religious teaching, dogma, etc. The near-death experiencers generally come back being more spiritual. Sometimes they go to church more often, sometimes they go to church less often. There's usually some kind of a shift. They're certainly far, far more interested in spiritual matters than they were before the experience.
How about a change of life when they come back? Are they psychically inclined or anything like that?
You know, it's interesting, pretty close to half, probably about 40% of near-death experiencers that come back do believe that they have some increase in their psychic abilities, and I actually did a very detailed study of that. I mean, psychic is a very broad term. Well, what do you mean by that? So I asked them. I asked, you know, over 100 near-death experiencers in a survey. And the results were kind of interesting. There's a wide variety of types of psychic phenomena. A typical thing is near-death experiencers often state they can't wear watches. There seems to be a phenomenon of electrical sensitivity, which, again, no one really understands very well. It just seems to be very, very common in what they describe. But this type of psychic ability that I see most consistently in the survey I did seems to be more of an intuitive or knowing. In other words, when they're around people, they can sense what they're feeling, sense what they're thinking at a much higher level than most people can, and certainly at a higher level than they could before. My hypothesis when I see that kind of result is I just think these people are probably more loving and lovingly connected, attentive, aware, alert. I think that probably would explain a lot of what I'm seeing in terms of their psychic ability, but certainly not all of it.
Let's talk a little bit now about Dr. Kevin Nelson's research in the moments that we have left in this hour before we go to calls next hour, Jeffrey.
Sure.
I guess had you been part of this study, would you have changed it?
If I had been, I was kind of. I actually emailed the near-death experiencers we had in our database that allowed me, gave me advance permission to email them and let them know about this study. So I actually was involved in recruiting the near-death experiencers. Now, having said that, that was my only role, and I'm not a co-author of this study at all, and was not really involved in the production of this article. That's a real good question. If I were involved in this study, I think I would have done it substantially differently. I would have asked people when they had these types of out-of-body experiences or so-called REM intrusion experiences to describe in great detail what they were actually talking about. I'd want to make this what's called a prospective study, if at all possible. In other words, you'd get people that had a life-threatening event and then ask a large group of people these types of questions that Dr. Nelson did, and that way you'd have a much, much more solid conclusion than was possible with this type of study, which is technically called a retrospective study, or if you will, looking backward type of study.
Now he's got a line here that says, "We found it surprising that out-of-body experience with sleep transition seemed very much like out-of-body experience during near-death." What's he saying there?
Oh, he's talking about, again, you know, people that have these types of, sort of semi-dream state types of out-of-body experiences. For the whole past several hours, it was extremely clear that near-death experiences have nothing to do with that. In fact, what he's talking about are basically called, technically, hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. The term hallucination is real. When people have these types of experiences around falling asleep, typical symptoms, unlike near-death experiences for these, what he's talking about are falling sensations, fears, sensing a presence, often evil. They may feel a pressure sensation on their chest or back, a sense of not being able to breathe, a sense of impending doom. Again, hallucinations that are clearly not real to the person experiencing this when they wake up. Out-of-body experiences where what they're seeing or hearing in the out-of-body state are not real. And as you can tell, none of that has anything to do with near-death experiences at all.
No, he seems to imply that sleep has a lot to do with it.
Well, you know, again, there's absolutely no way. You know, when you talk about, we've talked about, you know, when you have a cardiac arrest, when your heart stops, within 10 seconds, your measure of electroencephalogram, measure of brain electrical activity goes flat. You can't have a thought. We actually at one point did a survey where we asked our near-death experiencers if the experience was, quote, dreamlike in any way, unquote, deliberately worded to encourage a positive response if there was any relationship whatsoever with what they experienced in dreams. And the bottom line is the NDEers almost unanimously indicated that the experience, the near-death experience, was not only not like a dream, but adamant that it was nothing like a dream whatsoever. So again, ask going to the original source, the near-death experiencers, they're adamant this isn't related to anything that goes on. You know, and again, Dr. Nelson, he talks about REM or rapid eye movement as being a part of near-death experience. Well, if that were true, George, wouldn't it be impossible for somebody who's blind from birth and has no REM during their entire life to have a visual NDE?
Right, you would think so.
Well, absolutely you would, and yet there's actually been several dozen blind people, including some blind from birth, that have, about 70% of these groups, have visual near-death experiences. That's absolutely impossible if REM intrusion, rapid eye movement intrusion, were a part of the near-death experience. That could not happen. And again, we've talked about NDEs occurring when they're deep under general anesthesia. Again, you know, you have a cardiac arrest as a surgical complication. Absolutely impossible that that's related to REM intrusion.
Is there anything that came out of the study that you would welcome?
Yes, there's an interest in doing research in near-death experience. There's not a whole heck of a lot of that. I certainly would reiterate that Dr. Nelson is a brilliant and very accomplished neurologist. I have a great deal of respect for work like this. I may not disagree with the conclusions, but this work is still very, very important because we need to look at all possible explanations of near-death experience. They need to be carefully considered and pros and cons bandered about in the scientific literature through the way we usually banter back and forth as researchers. If Dr. Nelson wanted to do another NDE study, I would be first in line to help him out in whatever way I can, or anybody else that's a, you know, credible scientist and a well-known academician. So, you know, I certainly think that this is important. I certainly think that it's reasonable to consider all possible medical explanations of the near-death experience, because only after we've considered all possible explanations and found that they really don't hold water, that they're not valid, then and only then can we convince the greater scientific world beyond a shadow of a doubt, even with their level of proof that they require, that near-death experience is absolutely for real.
20% of the people in your study, 20% had a life review. Would you consider that low or high?
That's about average. You have to have a fairly detailed experience before you have a life review, so that's just about par for the course. That's certainly consistent with what a lot of other researchers are finding. It seems to be about 20%. You know, as we've said before, there's really no near-death experience, or virtually no near-death experience, that has all the known elements of the experience. People generally have a few elements or even many elements, but a lot of the elements that occur with near-death experience, out-of-body experience, seeing a light, deceased relatives, life review, a barrier, as we discussed, the probability of those occurring is about in the 20 to 40% range for all those types of elements.
What I find fascinating about the life review, even though it's only 20%, is that it would happen at all. When I was a kid, being raised, I was always told there was a book of your life that, you know, would be read to you upon your death. That's a life review, and yet these people see this. Now, the question, Jeffrey, is do they see it because they've been taught it, or does it really happen?
That's a good question. as far as I'm concerned, the best evidence from all these experiences suggests that it really happens. You know, as you've said, it's very typical that people talk about a book of their life. The great, great majority of people having a life review don't actually encounter a book. And in fact, we've had two very dramatic experiences where their life review occurred as the beings that they were with put a little round silver disc, which, you know, looks somewhat like a CD, into a device, and then that sort of opened up a review of their life. Now, the interesting thing is that one of these people that I recall vividly, where they used that life seemed to be attached to that CD-like object, they had their NDE a decade or two before CD-ROMs were invented. And then several decades later, when they saw CD-ROMs starting to come out, they said, aha, that's what I saw in my near-death experience. So again, not related to a book, you know, and quite astonishing. But that's, you know, life reviews generally, when they happen, they see as if they describe it like a movie or a 360-degree panorama of movie, if you will, or sometimes they even relive, and it seems like they're almost back in their body reliving their life. And the other thing that's interesting about these is about one out of three times, not only are they reliving and feeling what they felt during their prior life, but in addition to that, when they encounter other people during their life review, they actually feel and know and sense what the other person felt like that interacted with them. You know, just one of the amazing twists that we see over and over again in these life reviews.
When we take phone calls, what would you like? What do you expect?
I would be very interested in people sharing their near-death experiences. You know, just come talk about it. If you have any questions about the experience, I'd be glad to see if I can answer it. But I would just be very, very interested to just, you know, have people share what happened straight from the source.
And for someone to have a near-death experience where it would be a bona fide, do you have to have a medical practitioner around or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely not. Most near-death experiences, in fact, the great majority of near-death experiences occur outside of a hospital setting. So as a result of that, there's no possibility of having a medical practitioner around. How you validate that there's an imminent life-threatening event is several-fold. First of all, you look at the circumstances, like the NDE we talked about earlier. If you have a rapid head-on car collision and then you have an out-of-body experience and observe yourself unconscious and you're having no conscious thought while you're physically in your body, this experience is totally separate from your physical body. That certainly would meet any reasonable definition of an imminent life-threatening event that would be required for a near-death experience. So what we're looking for is people that have had real serious life-threatening events, heart attack, anything, very, very severe trauma where they physically lost consciousness, where they were incapable of having a physical thought, and yet they had some experience that was very vivid, very lucid, and to them very real, and that would be a near-death experience.
I wonder what determines death, whether the body indeed dies or whether the spirit, the being, just decides not to go back in.
Yeah, that's a really good question. From near-death experiences like this, it's, clearly we talked earlier about some shared near-death experiences where one person, two people or more had a severe traumatic event simultaneously, and one person died permanently and went away and the other person didn't. There, at least from the interaction I've encountered during those shared near-death experiences, it seems that there's, you know, clearly if the physical body is just simply incapable of supporting life, that comes to be understood at this time. People get that. I mean, if they're really, really messed up badly, they know that their time is done. So the spirit can separate, but there has to be enough physical viability before they're going to be able to return to Earth and continue their earthly existence.
I wonder how many spirits go back in the body, even though the body is physically dead, and they just hang around in there because they don't want to leave.
And, you know, that's a really good question. None of the data that I have out of over 1,000 near-death experiences really addresses that, and I don't recall that being described. That doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, though, and that leads to your prior question. Could that be how ghosts occur? Could that be the origin of ghosts? And I don't know. That's a fascinating question, and I just don't have the data that really addresses it.
Are you going to continue to do research, or, you know, are you finished now?
Oh, no, I love doing this. A lot of what we're doing, we've talked a lot about the research I do, but, George, the number one reason I started doing this and would be motivated to continue to do this is that this is truly a public service. it is important for me to represent to the world what these experiences are honestly, objectively, and I can't think of a better way to do that than just to simply post every single near-death experience that we get. That empowers people to go to the website and read all these experiences themselves to form their own conclusion. Nobody has to listen to my conclusions and accept them. But I would encourage people, go to the website, go to other sources of credible near-death experience accounts, come to your own conclusions in your own time and in your own way.
And when they do, what do they generally conclude?
Well, the evidence is so overwhelming from going over these body of experiences that for the vast number of people to do that, I think it really changes people, and I think it changes people positively. I think it reduces their fear of death. I think the message is overwhelmingly powerful in this overwhelming body of evidence that there not only is an afterlife, there's an afterlife for all of us, and it's wonderful. I think it dramatically helps people deal with grief. You know, people that have lost a loved one, many of these people come to the website, read these accounts, and they come away with a very heightened sense that, hey, my loved one, not only are they okay, but they're probably, well, not probably, they are in a better place than you and I, George.
Does that mean there's no heaven and hell as well?
These realms that they describe in terms of the intense love that near-death experiencers experience in the unearthly realms, the love they feel, the intense peace, connection, I mean, this is truly heaven, I think, not only heaven, but far better than heaven is represented on Earth in every way.
All right, stay with us. We're going to be right back. We'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Lots of calls for you, Jeffrey. Do you see a difference in near-death experiences from Americans as opposed to people who are from Japan or China or Russia?
You know, that's a great question. Our NDE website is in over 20 different foreign languages, so we've accrued the largest collection of non-English NDEs in the world. What is startling is their similarity across different country borders, across different cultures. Again, we see over and over remarkable consistencies, even in people all around the world. Some of the strongest evidence suggests from all that this really is a global phenomenon, that really NDE is really globally significant.
Okay, we're going to go to the calls. Please take your time with your story. Don't feel rushed. I want you to get it out here or your question for our guest, Dr. Jeffrey Long, MD, not PhD type, just a medical doctor. What do your colleagues tell you, by the way? Are they excited about your work, or do they think, uh-oh, here's another one we've lost. He's gone over the other side.
Yeah, you know, most physicians really don't have time to become familiar with a variety of paranormal phenomena, so they have a strong bias against its possible reality, not based on any evidence, but just based on their belief without really knowledge of what it's all about. Now, the interesting thing is when I sit down and talk with my colleagues and tell them, hey, I'm a near-death experience researcher, and actually explain the phenomena to them, the significant majority of doctors are actually quite sympathetic. Beyond that, they're actually saying, wow, that's amazing, they're fascinated, and they kind of get it. So it's just I think the issue is just educating my medical colleagues about what this is all about.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going east of the Rockies. First of all, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Steve in Houston, Texas.
Hi, Steve.
In 93, I was shot within 3 feet, close range was 9 millimeter, and did a lot of damage to me. The bullet spent itself on my spine, and through and tore me up. Starburst my liver. I lost a kidney. All sorts of nerves were severed. I was still, from the waist down, I'm semi-invalid. But the third time my heart stopped on the operating table, unbeknownst to me, by the way, I was wide awake. All of a sudden I was conscious, and I realized I wasn't breathing, and I wasn't scared. It didn't bother me. And, immediately, I saw a figure in a gleaming white robe and a brightness in his face. I could see his hair, and he lit the room. And the room appeared to be a carved stone or something. It was a warm atmosphere, and it seemed like it had a carpet on the floor or something like that. And he approached me through an arched doorway and held out his right hand as if to beckon me to come to him. And at that point, I was so shamed that I, in my mind, I fell on my face before him and communicated to him without words that, Lord, I'm not worthy. And at that point, I didn't see him anymore because I was fearful of the Lord, and I heard him say, if you want to live, take a breath. And I asked him a question. It was kind of stupid. Can I do that? Or I don't think I can, you know. Well, he didn't answer, didn't say anything. He just told me what to do. And I didn't want to cross over because, of, you know, like I say, I didn't feel like I was worthy. But he gave me the choice to stay, and he told me what to do. And at that point, I started breathing, and the anesthesiologist, once he got a good heartbeat on me, took me way down, and I don't remember anything after that except the main surgeon. At the time that I was my brain was conscious, I heard a voice say on the right, we're losing him. And the other doctor on the left, I heard it in my left ear say, well, he's gone. And I heard the flat line. And that's when it changed to the vision of what I call the Lord. So.
All right, Jeffrey, how do you take this?
Yeah, wow. Steve, thanks a lot for sharing that remarkable experience. No question about that being a near-death experience, you know, heart stopping, and you hear the flat line, it's that kind of ee sound
right,
when the
right.
You know, EKG that they always have in an operating room goes flat. And immediately after that, you start having your experience. A couple things that you bring out, Steve. First of all, essentially all near-death experiences, communication is telepathic. It's not physical. It's not through words. You're not using your vocal cords. It's sort of thought to thought, and often it's described as a very rapid transfer of thought and often associated with emotion or feeling as well. You know, certainly having a figure appear like that in an arch or, you know, have the, you know, in kind of a, the physical appearance you describe of the room, I've certainly heard before. You know, Steve, you told this being you encountered that you were, quote, not worthy, unquote, essentially always in near-death experiences, while the near-death experiencer may feel that they're not worthy or be humbled in some way, almost never does that being of light that they encounter pass judgment in that way. In other words, it would have been vanishingly rare, almost unheard of, if that being had responded to your statement that you're not worthy by agreeing or by acknowledging it or by some way addressing that. These beings that they encounter, and you know this full well, Steve, are intensely loving, intensely accepting. You're basically loved totally for who you are, all that you are. And, you know, that's one of the very consistent themes in the near-death experience. And that's really interesting, too, Steve, that this being you encountered told you, if you want to live, take a breath. Periodically, we see some direction or instructions in near-death experience that probably results in the person returning to life, which is really interesting how, you know, the experience that people are having can literally save their life and help them come back to Earth. So that's does that sound like a reasonable discussion there, Steve?
I think it is. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
This is Jeff from Palo Alto, 560 AM.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks.
Very good. And my background research is somewhat analytical in several topics, not medicine. I suffered a fibrillation several times under enormous stress in Silicon Valley, and And I was taken to the hospital twice. And I should preface this. I called Dr. Benson from Harvard because it was suggested that stress was enormous, that I should exercise the relaxation response. That was a relatively recent book. And I only spoke to him briefly. I spoke to an assistant, and I began thereafter. It's a form of TM, if you're familiar, a doctor would be. And it's just a form of meditation. I practice that twice a day. And then I had another fibrillation, and I had it at home. And it was early evening in bed with my wife. And it happened instantly, the occasion. It was painful, and the anxiety was great. And instantly, I was taken up, and I could see just very, very briefly my body. And then I shot through a tunnel. Now, you have to understand, I'm quite analytical about this experience, and I'll describe it. I raced at an enormous speed, and I was going forward, but here's a critical part, because I've researched this in textbooks, but I've also had another experience speaking to someone had a similar experience. But I'll finish mine. I go through the tunnel. I go through an actual, you can't see the tunnel. It's dark, but there's enormous sound of, I'd say angelic, but that's my twist on it.
Sure.
Of women. The voices, but we're talking about millions of them, singing. It's not Latin. While I had a background in Latin, yes, but it's not Latin. It's a combination of several dialects somewhat, but Latin is an undertone. And I go toward, at first the tunnel, we're speaking in there's no time or space, but you're racing towards something. And then slowly you see a light at the end, this traditional view, and it's crystalline. There's no figure here. There's a crystalline presence, a light, and it's somewhat vertical there. And I slow up and I stop, and it's a wonderful response. And it is a telepathic communication between myself and, I'd say, I can't say person, but it has to be a person of some dimension. And what happens is that it's an enormous, it's a wonderful, pleasant, inviting environment. It's a form of ecstasy. And then I'm asked, this is be wonderful, you're invited. I don't see anybody. It's just an incredible environment. I cannot describe the environment. I'm invited into this environment, and what happens is I'm given a choice. Again, it's telepathic communication. And at that point, I choose my family. At the time, I had two youngsters, and I asked, look, if I leave now, and I really wanted to leave, doctor, but I'm given this choice, and I choose my family, not my boys. I'd leave the family. And I didn't want to see them destitute or suffer through life without a parent.
Yeah.
And then what happens, I go instantly back into the bed next to my wife. I wake her up and I ask, did you hear the music? It wasn't music. I'm saying music, the voices and the singing. And she was a bit frightened when I woke because she'd suffered two episodes before my coming and going. But she said, what? Didn't you hear the voices? It was that real. That is the experience. Now, 1 year later, I'm in Los Angeles, and I'm a conference, and I meet a social worker, and she is about 32, and we became talking about experiences, and she had mentioned, she just brought up the subject of meditation, and that she had experienced meditation when she was in high school and early at UCLA. And we started talking, and I let her speak about her experience. Interesting enough, doctor, it was similar to mine. But the test was, she goes through the tunnel, goes through the light, but there, how she was initiating it was through meditation. So I'm asking her this, and I'm playing like I have not had one, was very curious about it. And then I said, by the way, and this was the test, she discussed everything similar to mine, with the exception of the voices and the tone. And then I said, did you hear any music or any voices? Yes, how did you know? And I said, no, actually, I had an experience, but what was the voice like? You know what? It's odd. I never took Latin, but it sounded like Latin. I've heard it on records and stuff, but it sounded like Latin voices. Here's the question. I had experienced some form of meditation to address the anxiety and tribulation, and I always wondered if that meditation played a role in my near-death experience. That's my first question. Second question is, there was a interesting in the 1980s, there was proportionately a greater number of near-death experiences. And, you know, I don't know how to address that, but that figure. But that's my story. And if you could help me and resolve this, it'd be wonderful, Doctor.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that, Jeff, that remarkable experience. Just for the listeners, you described the life-threatening event as, quote, fibrillation, unquote. Medically speaking, what that is a dysfunctional beating of the heart such that the heart is not able to pump enough blood to sustain life. So that is truly a life-threatening event when you have fibrillation. I mean, that's a serious heart problem that you know, is not, certainly incompatible with life on it if it continues. That's a very beautiful story you shared. Very fascinating. You talked to the social worker and you talked about Latin voices. I can't recall another experience like that. So for you to have experienced that and then find somebody else during meditation that experienced the same thing, you know, it's kind of interesting because over and over in these NDEs, we hear about these kind of incredible serendipitous events. It really makes you think that maybe just perhaps there's some guidance going on a universal level to bring two people together that really needed to talk and share, and that it's important, and that you know, that's more than just an accident. You may well have had that sense about all that, meeting that social worker as well, Jeff. I would wonder. Certainly the telepathic communication is there, the pleasant environment, no sense of time or space is absolutely typical of near-death experiences. Now, to get to your question, you're wondering if meditation played a role in the near-death experience. That's interesting. You know, certainly my view of near-death experiences are they're co-created events. They're sort of the being or the part of the experience that is the actual near-death experiencer, and yet there's some co-created part of the experiencer that is something above, beyond, something outside of this earthly realm that also plays a role in the experience. So it's very possible that any prior life experience may have been in some way a part of the near-death experience.
And how about meditation? How much does that help?
No one has really correlated the people that have a history of meditating with having a higher probability of NDE or having a different part of a near-death experience than people that don't meditate. But again, that's also something that hasn't really been looked at carefully scientifically. So that's a real question, and that's certainly food for thought for future research. But yeah, that's very, very interesting. The other point I would make is that now that I've studied with between all three websites that I have, including after-death communications, out-of-body experiences, actually over 4,000 experiences shared on all the websites, I'm increasingly convinced that near-death experience is part of a spectrum of experiences. In other words, there can be absolutely parts of elements of a near-death experience that occur under other circumstances, and meditation is not unusual. Other circumstances not associated with the life-threatening event. So that could be.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls, final experiences on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Jeffrey Long. We'll take your final calls. And again, take your time. I'm not going to rush through your calls. And believe me, you've died. There's no need to rush through these for you. I give you the respect there. You've come back. And Jeffrey, your website's all linked up at coasttocoastam.com, all three of them.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
My pleasure. Let's go back to the calls. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Angie calling from Northern California.
Hello, Angie.
I wanted to share with you an experience that up until tonight I've always perceived as an out-of-body experience, but listening to Jeffrey describe some near-death experiences, that would be one of my questions is I'm interested in how he would perceive it. It happened when I was four, and I had had an incident where my arm had gotten caught in one of those old-fashioned wringer washing machines up to my elbow joint, which, of course, without becoming too graphic, grinding away the flesh, left the joint completely exposed. There was no skin there. And going to the hospital, of course, I'm sure they explained very well to my mother what the process was they were going to do. But what I got out of their explanation, what it was they were going to do was merely take skin graft off of the thigh of one of my legs to provide the skin. But in my mind, they were going to cut off my leg.
Oh,
and
my.
When I went into surgery, as they were wheeling me down the hall, I was so extremely terrified. I remember very clearly, literally screaming and just clinging to my mom, begging her, don't let them take me. They were going to cut my leg off. In my reality, the girl in the bed next to me, a little bit of why that was so terrifying to me in the hospital room with me, had fallen under a train and been ran over by a train. Her right leg had been completely severed at the hip, her left leg at the knee. So to me, it was very terrifying to think they were going to remove my leg like this girl who I watched every day. And my terror was so extreme that even under anesthesia, I went in, and I remember as they put the mask over my face and all those things, still screaming, and was just so terrified. And at some point throughout the procedure, I suddenly was just up above in the room. I remember the room very well. It was a very small operating room, real icky, kind of a green color. And being up observing, saw my body, was very aware, initially still very much in this state of panic, and then just almost instantaneously, the gentleman a few calls before who was trying to describe this environment that he found himself in, I could totally relate to what he was saying, and it's really is impossible to articulate, and I don't remember any specific communication per se other than experientially. I suddenly was just, it was so soothing, just this very calming, you know, it was almost like someone taking my soul in their arms and saying, it's okay. Just immersed in this very loving, warm, embraced environment. I don't know what other word to put on it. And I watched my body laying there, and it happened to be at the point as they were removing the skin from my leg, and I watched the doctor, again, no sense of, you know, space and time, so I don't know how long I actually was observing, but it had to be a good amount of time. I watched him remove a couple of layers of skin, and it was just a very fine, almost like a cheese grater thing, peeling very, very thin layers of flesh, and the doctor would then turn and place that retrieved layer of flesh into the incubator and would turn back, and I was just able to, from a very comfortable, safe, objective perspective, come to realize, oh, well, they're not taking my leg at all. They're just taking skin. That I can deal with. And then being able to just very peacefully and from a very calm place, go back into my body. I never thought of it as a near-death experience because, you know, there were no tunnels. There wasn't all of that, all the bells and whistles that a lot of people talk about. But as I was hearing you describe earlier a near-death experience, you seem to kind of expand what apparently in my mind had been a more limited definition of what would qualify as a near-death experience. And as you were talking about through the stories that you've done, some of the common traits that you've seen people who have had these experiences have, the unable to wear watches. I've just finally given up. I've bought watches from $10 watches to my husband has bought me very expensive watches, hoping, well, maybe this she'll be able to wear. It doesn't matter. I can't wear them. Very intuitive, extremely empathic, sometimes overwhelmingly so. So much of what you went down this kind of a little list, and I actually wrote it down here. I was going, oh, my God, he's talking about me. Mm-hmm. I could really identify with what you were saying there. And then more recently, about a year ago, I had I was extremely ill with pneumonia, and in fact so ill that my lungs would just rattle and wheeze as I would try to sleep. So I came out this particular night and slept on the couch so that my husband could sleep. And I had just started a round of antibiotics and codeine type cough syrup the doctor had given me. And I had to sleep sitting up. And I was sleeping out here. And although I was asleep, I'm also a very lucid dreamer. I'm very, some part of me is always very conscious and aware, even when I'm asleep. And this was, of course, so while I was laying here sleeping with the pneumonia, and some part of me was listening to the rhythm of my wheezing, the noise of my breathing, and suddenly I became aware that I hadn't heard that noise in some period of time, and I went, oh. And I realized, again, there were no visitations, and there was no tunnel, and there were none of those things, but I realized I was very aware that I was dying. And again, the other person that talked about the choice, if you want to live, you need to take a breath.
Do you always see the tunnel, Jeffrey?
No. Probably only about a fourth of people that have a near-death experience see a tunnel. So that's not at all unusual. In fact, the majority of people don't see a tunnel in an NDE.
All right. That is. I didn't think that was the case.
Yeah. Do you got any more to share, Angie, or shall I jump in?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for sharing, Angie. Your four-year-old experience when you were four, when you were, saw yourself at the time of a surgery, that's what I would call an NDE-like experience. And the reason for that is a near-death experience, as the name implies, you really need to physically be close at or very, very close to death. When you had your consciousness apart from your body, you saw the surgeons going on doing what you would have expected to do in the surgery, and that would have been removing skin and putting it in the incubator. If you had coded, if your heart had stopped, or if you had some severe physiological compromise during that operative procedure, what you would have observed would have been very, very different. You would have seen them trying to resuscitate you and, you know, a fair amount of panic and things like that. Having said that, certainly, you know, listen to what you described. The out-of-body experience and what you saw is absolutely, undoubtedly what was going on. During the time that they did that, you felt that loving warmth environment, that it was safe. You know, certainly the OBE with you know, almost certainly what you were seeing being absolutely real. So that's what we would call an NDE-like experience. That's part of the spectrum of NDE experiences. An NDE-like experience can certainly be absolutely as significant, meaningful, life-changing, and important as a full-blown NDE. You know, certainly a lot of people that have NDE-like experiences are aware that consciousness can live apart from the body. It can give them a great deal of courage about, you know, facing death. It can certainly affect their attitude about the world we live in. And, you know, that's certainly a possibility. And, you know, as far as your second experience, you know, certainly if you had a sense that you weren't breathing, that could well have been an NDE, you know, if you were clear you weren't breathing and then had some type of a lucid experience, that would certainly be closer to the realm of what we would call for research purpose a near-death experience. I want to emphasize sometimes, you know, even though we, for research purposes, we have definitions and we draw the line between experiences, there's certainly a lot of overlap. And even if someone didn't come close to dying but had a dramatic experience like you had at age four, Angie, you know, that's still a very important, meaningful, and significant experience in your life, as I'm sure you're aware of.
West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Dr. Jeffrey Long. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Albert from Anderson, California, and I actually just have a question.
Okay, Albert.
I believe in NDEs totally. I've read a lot about them and everything, but I just have a question. Now, when a person is dying, is it not true that their brain is the last thing to die? So I'm wondering that, you know, these people, I mean, say hypothetically, is it possible that maybe they're just having residual brain activity and they're not really dead? I mean, they appear dead to us, but they're not, and, you know, we call them clinically dead, but they're not really dead. These are near-death experiences. So, I mean, what actually happens when the brain is completely dead, and how long does it take for the brain to die? Because, like I said, I'm just wondering if maybe this is just residual brain energy, you know, because
yes.
The brain is still alive. They
sure.
appear dead to us, but the brain is still alive.
Sure, that's a good question. When the heart stops beating, when you clinically die, within 10 seconds, there's no measurable brain electrical activity yet that is measurable. It should be absolutely impossible to have any kind of organized experience. When a person is dying, you know, unfortunately, I've talked to people that have in my medical practice, you know, that are going through this, you know, or have had a near dying event and not having an NDE. You really don't have any. There's no potential to have an organized experience. You can't have. I mean, you could be fragments of memory or generally no memory. But don't forget, when you're dying, you're very quickly passing to unconsciousness. And by the very medical definition of unconsciousness, un meaning no, conscious, you can't really have anything like an NDE. If NDEs were just fragmentary or very, very brief experiences and disorganized and scattered, that would be consistent with residual brain activity potentially. But when you start having people that have their consciousness apart from the body, what they see and hear is really what's going on, that is absolutely not medically consistent with somebody that's unconscious or dead at that point in time.
Yeah, these people are only dead for a very short period of time, though. I mean, if it was like a week or something and they came back, that'd be different. But it's kind of like having a TV plugged into a wall. There's the TV is off and it appears dead to us, but there's still a current going through, and you can't really say that that the TV's dead until you unplug it from the wall, the source of electricity. So I'm just thinking that, you know, they're not really completely dead. I mean, maybe they are. You know, I believe in NDEs, but it's just a hypothetical question,
yeah.
You know, brain
right.
activity, you know.
Right. And to take your analogy further, sure, the TV's plugged in and it's technically not dead, but it's not forming any image. In other words, it's not able to convey information. You can't. There's no detailed, you know, if you will, experience going on within that TV set because it's operating at such a low level. You know, people are very, very clear. That's one thing that even among skeptics of NDEs in the medical community, one thing they're very clear on is that, you know, number one, NDEs are for real. And number two, you know, when you're medically close to death, there's no medical explanation for having these types of incredibly detailed experiences, life reviews, tunnels, encountering deceased relatives, encountering boundaries, all far, far more detailed than a dying brain could even theoretically support.
Of the cases you've studied, Jeffrey, has anybody prior to the NDE not believed any of this, and then afterwards they were convinced?
Oh, absolutely. We see that a lot. Probably about 30-40% of our people didn't even know about near-death experience prior to their experience, and we do ask that in our web form. So, you know, and then other people heard about near-death experience, and we get some very dramatic accounts from people that are very, very clear that this is all hogwash and they don't believe it. I haven't had a single person who felt that way and then had a near-death experience come back and believe it's hogwash. In fact, we asked the near-death experiencers on our survey what they considered did they consider their experience to be real? And at the moment they've had their experience, probably because of pre-existing beliefs like that, you know, maybe 3-4% of people, you know, say it, you know, it might have been real or possibly real, but by the time they've had a chance to think about it and they're out many months to years after their experience, virtually nobody that has a near-death experience doubts its reality. You know, far less than 1% have any residual doubts.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Maybe one or two more calls, that'll be it. Hi there.
Hi there. This is Tracy from Massachusetts.
Yeah, Trace. Go ahead.
And I'm one of those people, I have just a few minutes, I realize, but I'm one of those people that was a skeptic that had no framework to attach to the experience I had. As an outpatient at a hospital, I was undergoing a diagnostic test, and I went into an anaphylactic reaction, severe reaction to the substance that they were using,
mm-hmm.
and went into a respiratory arrest, ended up being what they call coded. I can assure you that what I experienced now was very real to me. At the time, I would have been, as Dr. Lawn just described, a skeptic. What I did not experience what some of the people said. I did experience the tunnel. I experienced the out-of-body in the sense of looking, but it was extremely real. I could see and hear everything that was going on, but I was like a little head up in the corner of the room almost and just viewing the resuscitative attempts that were going on at the time. I could hear them saying things like more epinephrine, more adrenaline, thinking to myself, well, gee, I really can't be all that bad because I can hear this. I can see this. And yet I could feel nothing they were doing. It was like I'm watching my body but I can't feel anything they're doing to me at all. It's like it's me, but not me. And I thought, well, I can't be that bad because I can hear this, but I can't be that good or they wouldn't be doing all this. And just to interject a little bit of humor, when Dr. Lawn was mentioning things that you see that you wouldn't have had knowledge of, at a point during the procedure, there was a doctor that entered the room.
I got about 15 seconds left.
He had a pink tie on, which in the 70s wasn't a common thing. And I commented about this afterwards and the looks that I got from people, because this person came in at a time when there's no way that I would have been able to know that.
That must have just shocked the heck out of them. Jeffrey, we are out of time. Thank you, my friend.
It's been a real pleasure. Outstanding. Thanks for sharing, Tracy.
All right, very good. That's Dr. Jeffrey Long, who has taught us all about near-death experiences. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.